Well, I'm very pleased and honored this evening to introduce our speaker, Ms. Carolyn Summers. Carolyn is an adjunct professor in the Continuing Education Division at Westchester Community College, where she is able to share with students of that school her lifelong love of plants and animals. In fact, Carolyn was describing over dinner that she is now the organizer of a new curriculum which is centered on horticulture, natural resources, and sustainability that will be offered jointly between Westchester Community College and the Native Plant Center at that school. Carolyn has been one of the longtime advisors for that Native Plant Center, which is an official affiliate of the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center in Austin, Texas. Carolyn has a degree in landscape architecture from the City College of New York, and shortly after receiving that degree, went to work as the first ever landscape architect for the Department of Environmental Protection in New York City. While employed in that role by the DEP, Carolyn wrote and promoted the natives, or rather indigenous plants only policy for all New York City environmentally related projects. And that's a policy which is still in place and is still being enforced. Carolyn has also held positions with the Natural Resources Defense Council and with the Trust for Public Lands. She and her husband David maintain beautiful gardens of indigenous plants in Hastings-on-Hudson in the Lower Hudson Valley, and I feel very privileged to have been able to visit those gardens. They also are establishing an arboretum on a 300-acre tract of land that they have in the Catskill region, and all of the trees in that arboretum are natives or cultivars of natives. Carolyn has written a wonderful book, which I foolishly did not bring to the podium with me, but I can tell you that I've read many articles, many books on gardening with natives, and was particularly impressed with Carolyn's because of the very strong research focus and scientific focus that it employs in urging people to use indigenous plants in their own home gardens. Carolyn will be signing copies of the book after the lecture, and I strongly urge you to purchase a copy. At this point, it's a great honor for me to introduce Carolyn Summers.
Does that work? I'm not very good with machines. I'm better with plants. It's great to see you all today. Thank you, Don, for that wonderful intro. I'm honored to be here. I want to thank Don and his marvelous staff for a wonderful day today. We toured all around plantations. There's still a lot that I would love to see. And it will unfortunately have to wait for another trip, but what I saw today was very impressive. Beautiful landscapes, beautiful plants, and the wildflower garden was especially just lovely today. What I'd like to do today is walk everyone of you through what I've been going through and what I've written the book about, which is a very basic explanation of why it's important for us to have native plants or indigenous plants, as I referred to them in my book, in our landscapes. I use the words indigenous and native carefully. An indigenous plant, let's try going through some of the slides, and that will help, I think, illuminate some of this. This is really the crux of what I'm going to talk about. Gardeners for many years have gardened with plants according to the needs of the individual plants in terms of how much sun they need, how much shade they need, how much moisture they need, how much dryness they can take. And these have been traditionally right plant, right place kind of rules by which we have gardened. And we really haven't given a whole lot of thought to where our plants came from, and people really haven't thought that that was terribly important. Now, there have been some people all along who thought that that was interesting and who liked the idea of gardening with wildflowers, but by and large, that's been sort of a niche that has not been widely disseminated throughout the gardening world. So I'm here today to talk to you about why it's important to make this idea a little more mainstream. So first we need to define our terms. What is an indigenous or native plant? It's a plant that's evolved over millennia, not just the last 400 to 600 years since this continent was basically brought over, not since the Europeans came here, but I'm talking about glacial time. I'm talking about the time since the glaciers have left this part of the country, how the plants and animals have evolved together. So they grow without cultivation, that's the second bullet. And then the term native plant obviously requires a qualifier because all plants are native somewhere. So we have to say where they're native to. Even the term native itself can be somewhat confusing because many people will speak of the native plants of the United States or North America, and that type of broad brush qualification is not terribly useful. And I'm going to explain why in a little bit, why it's more important to be more regional than broad. Just as an example, here is a plant that I'm sure you can all recognize. It's a sumac tree. It's actually been trained as a tree, but in this photo, sumac's native to us, but in this photo, that photo was taken in Great Britain, where that tree is an alien. It's not native there. Here's another example of a plant that's native not only to our continent, but also to Great Britain. And this photograph was taken in Northumberland. These plants are called circumboreal or circumpolar, and these plants are native to more than one continent. So you see, it can get quite complicated, this idea of nativity or this idea of indigenous. New York has only been glacier-free for about the last 10,000 years, which shows you that the period of European colonization, which is 400 to 600 years, is just a blink of an eye compared to that. The plants that were brought here by Europeans and have naturalized or become common weeds are not native. They are simply naturalized, and there's a big difference to that. Because they are so recently introduced, they have not evolved or co-evolved with our fauna. So they're very, very separate, and we'll get into some of the issues with that. In terms of indigenous versus native, another important piece of information is where do you draw the line in terms of the North American continent? And really, we have to look again to geology for the answer to that. We were very fortunate in North America when the glaciers came through. Our mountain chain, the main mountain chain, the Rocky Mountains, runs north to south. In Europe, the Alps run east-west, and that fact is sometimes cited as a reason for the relative impoverishment of the northern European flora. Because what happened was when the glaciers came through in Europe as well, it pushed all the plants up against this impermeable barrier. Now, the same thing happened in the United States, except that in the eastern portion of the United States, plants were able to migrate south and then migrate back up. So we do have a more diverse flora. Where plants did not migrate is back and forth across the Rocky Mountains. And I will be able to give you an example of why that's an important issue. This particular plant is sort of the poster child for that issue. This is our own Eastern lupin. It looks very similar to the common garden variety lupin, which is a hybrid of the Western Lupinus polyphylla and some of the Eastern, Asian and European species with which it was bred to produce all of the different colors of the Russell lupins. And in fact, in the process of moving that plant around, Lupinus polyphyllus, the Western lupin, it became a garden pest in parts of the East. Why is that a problem? It's only a problem if it causes a problem for another plant or another species. And in this case, it seems to be more adaptable than the Eastern lupin and has taken over large areas that were actually given over to Eastern lupin. And that's a problem because the Karner blue butterfly can only raise its young on the leaves of this particular plant. The Western lupin fools the mother butterfly into thinking that it can lay its eggs on its leaves as well. And what happens is that the caterpillars try to eat that leaf, and there's some toxin that's not in Eastern lupin, but is present in the Western lupin that they simply cannot digest. A lot of this issue with native versus aliens does come down to leaf chemistry and the fact that certain insects have a very small range of tolerance of what they can and can't eat. And this brings up the issue in general of exotic invasive plants. So they've been recently introduced within the last few hundred years, not the last few thousand years. They spread without cultivation, and they cause harm, and that's the most important bullet in this whole issue. If they were just out there and not displacing natives or not fooling butterflies and things into thinking that they could use them, there would be no problem. And there are plenty of exotic plants that we have in our gardens that are relatively harmless. But the ones that we're going to talk about, the invasive exotics, are the ones that are causing problems. When plants travel, they leave their pests behind. This gives them a huge advantage over our own flora here. And it's one of the reasons, actually, that these plants become so sought after. Nurseries will be very quick to point out the fact that their plants are pest-free. Well, why are they pest-free? Because their pests are back on another continent somewhere. And in fact, their plants can't be used by our flora. And I mean, by our fauna. They can't be used by butterflies, caterpillars, and on up the food chain. Here we see a direct example of a plant, bittersweet, just pulling a tree down. I'm sure some of you who've been in some of the natural areas that are always under attack have seen examples like this. Another invader that is very common in our woodlands is Norway maple. And it's very easy to see early in spring when you've got a Norway maple because it's one of the first plants to leave out. And that in itself, just the leafing out, causes a problem. It shows us that it's out of sync with the context of its surroundings. This sugar maple forest on the right is... This photograph is taken at the same time the other photograph was taken, and you can see that there are no, if you look closely to this photograph, you can see that there are no leaves. Those are all flowers. The sugar maples won't leaf out for another week or two. Then they'll just start to leaf out, and it'll be another 3 to 4 weeks before there's a closed canopy in this forest. That's a native sugar maple forest with no Norway maples in it. And what that allows time for is for the ephemeral flowers, like this trout lily here, to actually complete their whole life cycle. They will flower, they will reproduce in that window of time that they are open to the sun. And at the same time they're doing that, they're providing nectar and food for a whole host of very early arising insects. And that in turn is going to provide food for the returning migrant songbirds. And there's the little guy sitting on top of the blossom there, bird food. So this is why we garden with native flora. We want to reconnect to the web of life. We're going to provide the only food for some plant, for some creatures like the Karner blue caterpillars. And this is the best shelter also for most wildlife. Now, I'm not going to tell you that native plants are super plants. They do require some maintenance. But by and large, once you've got them established and they're going to require less maintenance. For example, you do not need to fertilize native plants. Most of them don't even want to be fertilized. They don't like fertilizer. So right there, that's a big plus. They also require less water. Generally speaking, a lot of them are used to our cycle of lots of water in the spring and then relative droughty conditions during the summer. So they're generally going to be a little bit more drought tolerant than your average non-native. Now I'm going to use the words native and non-native throughout the rest of my lecture, because if I say indigenous and non-indigenous every single time, either I will trip over my tongue or this lecture will be twice as long as it needs to be. So you'll have to forgive me if I use native from now on interchangeably with the word indigenous, even though it's not quite as precise a term. So there's another reason here to preserve our regional sense of place and combat global homogenization. Maybe you're not aware that all across the northern tier of the United States, suburban gardens consist of almost all of the same species. Now, a lot of this is due to big box retailing, and we've got, you know, Home Depot and all of these big stores. They all have garden centers now, and they all sell pretty much the same plants from one end of the country to the other. Now, how boring is that? And here's another reason to garden with natives. It's a great way to involve children in your gardening activities. There's really nothing more exciting than taking them out and finding frogs and caterpillars and all of these wonderful things that they can actually come into contact with. So following up on the discussion of what butterflies and birds need, it is true that virtually all of our butterflies and moths require indigenous flora to reproduce. Most of them have very, very narrow limit of plants that they can use for their eggs and for their caterpillars to exist on. It's not so true of some other suites of insects. There are insects that are more varied and that can take some of the aliens. We obviously have alien plants that some insects are using. We also have a lot of alien insects that are using all of our plants, like Japanese beetles. But most butterflies are host-specific. Now, that means that you have to have one species of plant, or in the case, the most common case is the monarch. Most of you are familiar with the fact that monarchs need milkweed plants. Now, that means any plant in the within the genera of milkweeds, which means any asclepias they can use. Now, what they can't use is something closely related, like the invasive species Vincitoxicum, which is a vine which has entered the country and is now starting to fool some monarchs into thinking, because it's closely related but not closely related enough. And as we've already seen with the example of the Karner blue butterfly, even plants that look alike and are as closely related as those two forms of lupin, they're not necessarily going to be tolerated by one species that needs one only species. And fortunately, milkweeds are beautiful plants to have in our gardens. We really need to plant milkweeds for the monarchs. And most of you probably know that monarchs migrate to Mexico. What some of you may not know is, how do they get back? It is true that one fragile monarch butterfly that's flying out in the fields right now of Ithaca is going to make its way all the way down to Mexico. It's an amazing thing that something that fragile can actually travel that far and survive, let alone survive the winter in Mexico and come back again. Well, it isn't true that they come all the way back to Ithaca. What happens is they spend the winter in Mexico, and then they will come to the southeastern United States. That's as far as they can make it. And then they must find milkweed and lay their eggs. And then those offspring come further north and lay another brood of eggs. And then that brood will make it all the way up here to Ithaca into the northern parts of their range. It actually takes two or three broods just to get all the way up here. Now, if they don't encounter milkweed plants along their way, they can't complete their trip. So I urge all of you to plant. What I've got up here are the orange milkweed on the left and common milkweed up on the upper right with a fritillary on top, and purple milkweed in the lower right, which is a beautiful, beautiful, very sort of purpley pink. And I urge you to try any or all of these in your garden. They're very garden-worthy plants. And actually, some of you may not know, but the common milkweed, which looks very weedy to some people because it has really big leaves, has a wonderful honey scent. And you can, if you have a field of this, it is an absolute treasure when it's blooming and you have that wonderful scent. Spicebush swallowtail caterpillar. Now, this little guy is actually not on a spicebush. It's on a sassafras. So this is an example of a plant, of a caterpillar or a butterfly that can use two closely related but different species of plants. But again, it's very limited in those two plants. Fortunately, again, spicebush is another beautiful plant that we can all plant in our gardens to bring the spicebush swallowtail butterfly. Spicebush blooms at the same time as forsythia. It blooms yellow. And I personally like its lighter yellow, and the flowers are a little bit smaller. It's not quite as vibrant as the forsythia. It also doesn't spread as it doesn't take over large portions of your real estate the way forsythia can. It has beautiful fall foliage. And in the middle, you can see in the inset, that's a berry that the females produce that is very, very useful for birds. It ripens just before they migrate, and it has high levels of lipids in it, which are fats that the birds need to really propel them on their way south. Grasshoppers, what do they need? They need grass, but they cannot survive on lawn grasses because, again, our lawn grasses are not native. They're not indigenous. What you need for a grasshopper is a field that has some grasses in it that are native, that they can survive on, that they can eat, and that they can raise their offspring on. Native plants are four times as likely to attract native pollinators, and farmers are starting to realize that if they plant native flowers or native trees and shrubs near their farm fields, they will attract more pollinators than if they just rely on the honeybee population, which, as we sadly know, is starting to fall pretty precipitously. So to wrap this section of my talk up, I'd like to just reiterate that native plants really do provide the best, sometimes the only, source of food for wildlife, and therefore, indirectly, they're predators. And this gets into the whole issue of food chains. Moving up the food chain from butterflies and caterpillars, baby songbirds require insect protein to grow. Even birds who, as adults, will eat nuts and berries, they can't feed nuts and berries to their little ones. They have to have that protein from larvae, insect larvae, in order to thrive and grow and fledge. Native shrubs also make the best nesting habitat. There have been studies that show a big difference in the amount of birds that are fledged, from native shrubs versus those that are fledged from alien shrubs, exotic shrubs. No one's really sure of the reason for that, and it's pretty new research. My own theory is, one of the theories that I've read is that the branching structure of the exotics is so regular and so uniform that it makes it easier for the predators to find the nests. In other words, if they find one nest in an alien shrub, the other nests will be in a similar location. But I think it actually relates to what we've been talking about, and I think that the reason is that the mother birds and the father bird have to actually forage farther away from the alien shrub because there are no insects. If they're if they're nesting in a native shrub, there's going to be native insects already living on that shrub, eating those leaves, and they can just go right there and get their food. They don't have to fly away. And this means that they're right there to protect the baby bird from predators. And this is my theory. No one's proven it yet. I'm waiting for some scientists to come out and prove that so I can say, aha, I knew that. It's true that these studies have pretty much come up with the same conclusion. So again, it's important to plant shrubs if you're looking to, native shrubs, if you're looking to increase your bird populations. Now, to go to the other end of the birding year, where you're getting them ready to go and make their migration south, you want to give them the very best nutrition that we can offer them. And again, the exotic shrubs come up short. Studies have shown that the exotic shrubs are mostly carbohydrates and water, which the birds need. They need that too, but they don't have the high levels of fats that our native shrubs provide, because they've been evolved to provide that that really rich resource that the birds need to complete these amazing migrations that they undertake. So in the upper left, we have winterberry. Now, that's not something they're going to eat to send them on their way to migration. That's something that's going to hang around through the winter months. And amazingly, when the migratory birds come back in the spring, those winterberries will have hung around. They will have changed their composition slightly. They will have become more sweet because of the frost action. And then they will become palatable to those first returning migrants so that there's something for them to eat. So it's important to have a wide variety of native berries for the birds. The dogwood, these are Cornus florida dogwood berries on the upper right, and that is a very high source of lipids. We have a beautiful big tree where this photograph was taken that's covered with berries in the fall, and it's one of the first trees to get stripped. As soon as those berries ripen and they start to split like that, the birds are on them, and the trees are just filled with birds. The other berry on the lower, in the lower portion, is a berry that ripens in the summer, and the birds love that one so much that you really almost can't photograph them, because as soon as they're ripened, the birds have just stripped them right off. Sometimes they don't even wait until they're ripe. Sometimes they eat them before they've changed color. Here we have the hawthorns, another great bird food. The flowers are in the upper left, and another shot of dogwood, this time showing the berries and the leaves. Dogwood leaves turn beautiful shades in autumn, and I don't think that they get as much recognition for that because everyone is so focused on their beautiful spring flowers. Giant silk moths. How many of you have been privileged to see one of these in the wild? I mean, they're becoming so rare. You know, we have a problem because the gypsy moth control also controls these, and gypsy moths have caused a lot of problem for our silk moths. They only live for a few weeks, and do you know that they don't eat during that entire time? They have no mouth. So you can't lure them to your garden with nectar. They don't need to eat. What do they need? They need native trees for the most part. Their trees and shrubs are what they lay their eggs on, and that's all that they're around for. They're only here long enough to reproduce, lay their eggs on the type of material that they need, the type of plant material that they need, so that their little caterpillars can carry on. It's a very ephemeral creature. How many of you have heard Doug Ptolemy speak? I know he's been here to Cornell. His book, Bringing Nature Home? Yes. There's a wealth of data in his book, and his website is excellent too. According to Doug's research, white oak is, oaks in general win the prize for supporting the largest number of insects and butterfly and moth species alone. 517 species of butterfly and moth species will be supported by oak trees. So if you plant an oak tree, you're really doing a wonderful thing for the environment long term, because they are a long-lasting tree. The slide up here shows a white oak in flower. Something that the oaks don't really get a lot of attention for is their flowers, but they're actually very pretty. Here we have a hummingbird moth, another one that likes our trees and shrubs, and it's a very cute little animal for children. If you can find them, if you have a source of flowers that bring the hummingbird moths, they're a real attraction for kids too. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about principles of safe sex in the garden. Even though I've loaded you down with data about why it's important to plant natives, I know from experience, my own experience too, that we don't just plant natives. All of us gardeners are going to sneak a few exotics in there. It's just going to happen. I know it. So I thought it would be useful to actually come up with some guidelines for how to use the exotics responsibly so that we don't continue to add to the exotic invasives. So here are my principles. Most of the trees we plant will outlive us. Choose wisely. And by that, I really largely do mean to choose indigenous trees. I can't not think of an alien or exotic shade tree that can equal our shade trees. There's just really no need to plant an English oak. I don't know why nurseries offer them. I really don't. And they can't be used by our wildlife, and it's going to live for 200 or 300 years. We've already talked about the destructiveness of Norway maples, and most people who are knowledgeable don't plant Norway maples. And I've talked to nursery professionals who say, well, we don't sell Norway maples. And then I will point to the Crimson King Norway maple, the purple one, and I will say, well, what's that? And they'll say, oh, well, that doesn't reproduce. It's sterile. And I said, how do you know that? And the fact is they don't know. I think it's irresponsible of the nurseries to sell that particular plant, knowing what we know now about Norway maples. And I think that we have such beautiful shade trees, we really, for our future generations, it's really important. If you're going to plant a shade tree, please plant a native one. Now, the next few bullets of my guidelines only apply to exotic plants. So if you're looking in a nursery for plants and you see a brand new plant that you've never seen before and they say, oh, it's the latest thing we just brought back from China, think twice about that, because that's how a lot of our pests have gotten introduced. If you have a list of invasive species, just avoid. There are some plants that are just not safe to plant under any circumstances. Purple loosestrife comes to mind. I have a whole list in my book. Just if you find nurseries that are carrying them, that's irresponsible of the nurseries, and you should just totally avoid plants like that. Ampelopsis is still sold in nurseries. Do you know what that is? That's the grapevine-like thing that completely smothers large areas. It's still sold as an ornamental. I don't understand that. The next bullet, use only male dioecious species. That refers to plants like holly that come in male and female, and spice bush, male and female. If you're going to plant an exotic species, like, let's say, an English holly or an Asian holly, plant the male, and then you won't have any problem with reproduction if you're just planting the male. If we could find a way to teach roadside crews to cut down the female ailanthus, we could stop the spread of ailanthus, because female ailanthus are very easy to spot. They have tremendous seed heads on them this time of year, and if we took out the females and just left the males, it would be fine. But nothing is that easy. Using annuals is a good way to be responsible. The annuals are going to die at the end of the season. There's no harm in them. They're not going to offer anything by and large, they will not be offering much except maybe nectar for our butterflies, but they're not going to reproduce and cause a problem. Use heirloom plants. By that I mean plants that have stood the test of time. Lilacs are a good example, because you can walk into the middle of a forest that has grown up around an old homestead, and you will see the lilac trees are in the same place that they were planted by the pioneer ancestors, and those lilac trees haven't moved, and they haven't created new lilac trees or babies. They don't, for some reason, they're just not very persistent that way, and I don't know whether they're sterile or what it is, but they just don't seem to reproduce unless you actually cultivate them and plant them. So lilac trees are one of those trees that are pretty safe. They've been around for a while, so if you want a lilac tree, go right ahead. Roses, for the most part, unless they're species like a multiflora, most of the hybrid roses will not give you a problem. Someone asked me today about sterile plants. Now, the trick with sterile plants is to make sure they're really sterile, because as I just said, one of the nursery people that I talked with thought that the purple Norway maples are sterile, and there's no evidence that they are. If you can be sure that a certain plant is sterile, there are a lot of hybrids that are sterile, for example. Those are usually safe, but you really have to make sure. And that's not something that's terribly easy to do unless you know a lot about plants. Another trick is to use only a single specimen. Plants, by and large, will reproduce much more prolifically if they have companion plants, if they have another plant that they can cross-pollinate with. A lot of plants will only be partially viable, their seeds will only be partially viable unless they're cross-pollinated. So if you plant just one specimen, you may be all right with that. That's one method you can try. And then when you're using cultivated varieties, you need to stick with only one cultivated variety. A good example is Miscanthus. If you have a Miscanthus that's a particular clone, a particular named variety, and is propagated clonally, it cannot reproduce with itself, because essentially each plant is a clone. It's not a different plant. It's not different genetically. So the only problem with that rationale, or that method of keeping plants from spreading, is that if your neighbor comes home with the brand new Miscanthus that the nursery just released, which is an entirely different cultivar, well, they're going to mate. And both of you are going to have baby Miscanthus plants. You can see with all of these techniques, there are loopholes, and these are just some methods that I put out there as a way of getting people to think about the plants and what they're going to do when left to their own devices, which is they're going to reproduce. And it's up to us as responsible gardeners to keep, to not add to the additional invasive problem, and to try to do what we can to correct that. When all else fails, deadhead your plants. The simple maintenance of taking off the seed heads will go a long way. Now let's talk about some of my favorite natives, and natives that we can use as substitutes for some of the more commonly planted exotics. I want to again just say how wonderful oaks are. These are, this is a scarlet oak on my left. Again, some flowers and purple fall coloring of the white oak on the right. We have red maple here. This is our common red maple that everyone just totally takes for granted. And most people think of it as a fall coloring tree, a beautiful tree in the fall. And very few people are aware of the fact that some of them, not all of them, but the males, they sometimes separate into male and female. If you find a particular red maple that flowers heavily in the spring, that's a male, and it looks just like it's basically flowering, because it'll turn your whole hillside. We have quite a lot of them. It'll turn your whole hillside pink, and then that pinkness will fade and go away, and then the other red maples, the females, will come out with these little red wings, and it'll look like they're blooming. But it's actually not a bloom. It's not a blossom. It's actually those little red seeds. Not all red maples do that. I think the nursery industry is missing a bet here, and they should be picking out particular cultivated varieties that really have that that characteristic strongly. But they make beautiful yard trees in the spring if they have that characteristic. This is my candidate for the replacement of the dreaded Norway maple, Crimson King Norway maple. This is an actual choke cherry. It was found in Canada. It's sometimes called Schubert's Red. It's also called Canada Red. And it is just like every other chokecherry, except it has blossoms, it has bird food, it has beautiful long blooms, and then beautiful long streams of berries that the birds really do love. But it undergoes this interesting metamorphosis in late spring. It goes from a sort of a light green color, the leaves turn to this amazing purple shade. And they make magnificent, very showy trees. I planted a few of them in Westchester, and I'm trying to get the nurseries. It's amazing that they're not more popular. I wish that the nurseries would pick up on that. So go to your local nursery if you're looking for a purple tree and ask for this one. They're around, but you have to ask for them. Now, here are some native trees that may not at first blush look like native trees because they have this funny shape to them. One of the things that it's important to realize about native plants is that they're just as malleable and just as breedable and just as, I mean, you can just do as many things with them as you can with any alien or exotic tree. So the breeders have been working slowly but surely with natives, and now we have columnar trees, we have columnar maple trees, ash trees, and these are sweet gums. I wish I could have had a picture in the fall because sweet gums in the fall turn an amazing shade of red. And that would have been a very striking picture, and I'd really like to get back to that garden and take that photograph. But this is what they look like, and they're very interesting grouped in a sort of monolithic kind of grouping like that. But they also make very useful street trees in very tight places. Here's an example of why, and this probably points out the style issue pretty clearly. One of those trees, they're both topiaries. They're both done in the same topiary style. One of them is native, and one of them is non-native. Can I have a show of hands as to how many people think the one on the left is native? And how many people think the one on the right is native? The one on the right wins. But you can see it's really kind of a toss-up, isn't it? And it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference to us visually whether we're looking at the right or the left. It, in terms of how it reads in the landscape, it reads as a topiary. It reads as a very formal element in a very controlled and controlled context. So why would you use a non-native when you could use a native? Because after all, if you put the native in that spot, you're actually doing a huge benefit for this whole surrounding environment. If you choose the non-native, it's there. Maybe it's not going to reproduce. Maybe it won't cause a problem. But it's certainly not conveying any of the associated benefits that the native tree would be doing. And as far as looks go, it does the same. It sends the same message. Another great tree to use just in the landscape in general, I'm sure some of you are familiar with Amelanchier, and this is a spring, early spring bloomer, and there's even a pink version of it, a cultivar called Robin Hill. It has very graceful petals that sort of float in the spring sunlight. Very nice plant, nice bark too. This is golden St. John's wort. Many of you are probably familiar with the perennials of St. John's wort, but there are also a lot of shrubs. There are five native shrubs in this genus, and they're starting to become more widely available in the nursery trade. There's one called Sundrops, and this is a butterfly magnet. It's a very adaptable, tough shrub. You can, it's practically indestructible. You can grow it in full sun. You can grow it in shade. I particularly show this slide so that people can see that it does bloom in the shade, in dry shade, any kind of soil. It's just a wonderful plant to know about. Physocarpus, common nine bark, is becoming much more widely known. That's one that the nursery people have been having a lot of fun breeding, and now it comes in several different flavors, colors. It comes in Copertina, it comes in summer wine, which is the same color as that Diablo up there. Luteus is a sort of shocking green, shocking chartreuse, maybe. And then the common ninebark itself, the species, is also beautiful with just normally green leaves. And those in that picture, it's showing the seed pods. Those are actually the seed pods, which last, once the blooms fade in late spring, early summer, then you've got the seed pods going all summer long. They're very decorative. Native azaleas are a wonderful substitute for the honeysuckle bushes that are invasive and exotic and are actually being phased out. I think Connecticut and Massachusetts have stopped the sale of those. You can no longer sell those plants in some of the New England states because they've caused such problems. They have very honeysuckle-looking type blossoms. They come in a wide variety of colors and forms, and they naturally hybridize. So you can find in the nurseries, you can find hybrids, but they're hybrids of the natives, native versus native crossed with native, which still equals native, and I can't imagine that it would cause much of a problem for the caterpillars. I think they would all recognize that leaf chemistry. So I strongly advocate the use of these. Here is our own, probably have these in your woods. This is Pinkster Bloom, and this can also be purchased at many nurseries now. And it's a lovely plant, and it's very heavily scented and blooms early in the spring. Now, for those of you who are looking for something to replace boxwood, evergreen inkberry, Ilex glabra, is an excellent substitute for boxwood. Now, these are very large. There is a compact version. And like boxwood, you can shear inkberry, and you can make it as big or as large as you want. You can make that hedge still has the rounded form of the individual bushes, but it could be sheared into any shape that you want, just the same way you would do with boxwood. Now here's another interesting thing. We have American cranberry bush, which is identical. I mean, you really have to be a botanist to tell variety Americana from variety Opulus. The European guelder rose has been used in gardens for as long as the American cranberry bush has, and they've become a little bit confused in the trade. The fact is we really don't need variety Opulus because variety Americana looks just like it. So there's really no need to have it. There's actually a list, and I have some of these listed in my book, of plants that we use here that are European or Asian that we really don't need to use because it's just old habits. And we actually have American plants that look just like them. And if the nursery industry would phase them out, it would be a real benefit for the environment. I want to introduce the term congener that I'm using up here. Congener means that these are two plants of the same genera, different species, but same genera, so that you can have another good example is wisterias. You have Asian wisterias, Wisteria frutescens and Wisteria sinensis. Those are the Japanese and the Chinese. And this is American Wisteria macrostachya. Wisteria is the genera name. Same genera, but different species. And as we've already seen, these species behave very differently in the environment. And wildlife can't use the European or the Asian, whereas they can use our American versions. So it's really a better idea to plant these whenever possible. The other advantage to the American wisterias is that they don't bloom all at once and then stop blooming and just produce pods. They actually bloom on and off all summer. Now, full disclosure, they don't smell quite as good. But you have the flowers for a lot longer, so I think it's a pretty good trade-off. Here we have the same issue with honeysuckle. This is our native honeysuckle. It's a beautiful color. It's much prettier than the Japanese honeysuckle that's running wild through our woodlands. The Japanese honeysuckle does smell better, I'll admit it, but it only blooms for a short period of time. This plant will bring hummingbirds to your garden, almost guaranteed, and it will bloom beginning at the end of May. It will bloom right through till October. This is an amazing plant. It just goes on and on. Even after frost sometimes. It also produces berries that the birds love. So let's move a little bit further down and past the tree layer, past the shrub layer. Let's get to the ground layer. How many of you are familiar with bloodroot? That's a pretty common one of our earliest spring bloomers. And how many of you knew that there was a double-flowered version? This little thing looks like a pom-pom, or some people think it looks like a water lily. The only drawback to this plant, it's a very cute little plant, and it's very decorative in the garden, but it is sterile. It will not give your bees and your early insects any nectar like the regular bloodroot will. So it's fine to have a few of them, but you wouldn't want a whole garden full of them because you'd really disappoint your insect friends. Tiarella. Now, I'm talking about Tiarella. It's a pretty common plant, but there have been so many hybrids introduced into the marketplace, and people are sometimes disappointed, and I wanted to clear something up about Tiarella. It makes a great ground cover if you buy the right species. There are two native species. One runs and forms a ground cover mat, and the other clumps, and it makes individual clumping plants, very nicely used, as you can see in the upper right-hand corner, to border a path. But it will not do the same thing that you can see on the lower left, where it's an actual mat of plants. So if you want something that's going to be a ground cover that's really going to cover the ground, you want Tiarella cordifolia. If you just want something that's going to be an edging plant, then you're fine with one of the hybrids or the Tiarella wearii. Wild columbine, another common plant, but not used as much as it should be. And the trick with this plant is sometimes if you want it to stay in the same place that you have a place for it and you want it to stay there, a good idea is to deadhead it, because one of the reasons that it moves around so much is it seeds itself very prolifically, and sometimes it just seeds itself to death. And then that plant will die and you'll have all these little babies around and you'll wonder, well, what happened to the parent plant? So it's sometimes a good idea, if you'd like it in one place and one place only, to deadhead that one. And here's another, I particularly like tucking them into rocks. One of the common names of this plant is rock bells, and for good reason. They grow very well in rock gardens. Here is the Dicentra family. We have bleeding hearts. This particular bleeding heart, Dicentra eczemia, is similar to the honeysuckle I talked about. These will bloom all summer long. They will start blooming in May, and they are still blooming in my garden now, and they will still be blooming next month. So for year-round bloom, you can't beat them. On the other hand, they are closely related to Dutchman's breeches. Dutchman's breeches are one of our spring ephemerals that I talked about back when we were talking about Norway maples versus sugar maples. These little beauties produce their flowers and then they completely die back, so that if you plant them in your garden, you're going to probably want to plant something like a fern or something that's going to come up a little bit later and hide the spot where the Dutchman's breeches were, or you'll have a little bit of a hole in your bed. Another trick I like to use with ground covers is, instead of the mat look or the monocultural look, I like to mix them up and make it more of a mosaic. And two plants that work really well in that style are these wild geraniums and Jacob's ladder. You can interplant them and they grow together quite nicely. The foliage is very complementary and the colors work really nicely together. And there's a lot of native plants actually that you can do that with, because native plants don't tend to form monocultures and they don't tend to crowd out everything else. Dwarf crested iris. This is a real cute plant. How many of you know this plant? It's definitely getting out there, but still not as well known as I would like it to be. They look just like full-sized irises, but they're only 6 inches tall. The foliage is only 6 inches tall. It stays that way. And they have these adorable little iris flowers for a couple of weeks in late spring and sometimes into early summer. Lady slippers. Now, this is going to get into some dicey territory. People are going to think, did you dig those up? No. The lady slippers have been one of those goals for plant breeders for a long time. And Bill Kalina, New England Wildflower, and others have finally pretty much cracked the code on this. There's been a lot of work done with propagating native trilliums and native orchids. And there are still some you should not buy. I wouldn't go to your local nursery and try to buy the pink lady slippers, because I think there's still a little bit of work that needs to be done, and because they do need a certain type of mold or organism in the soil to really support them. So you could probably buy one that's been propagated by test tube micropropagation, but I'm not sure it would do all that well in your garden. But these yellow ones are very easy. I really didn't do much at all. There's Kentucky and there's large yellow, and they're actually, if you have a reasonably shady, reasonably moist part of your garden and you want to try these are pretty easy, good beginner orchids. Another great ground cover that is finally starting to get recognized is Canada anemone. And this will really form a bit of a monoculture. Again, you can introduce other plants into it if you like the mosaic look, but if you want something that's going to be a ground cover like a pachysandra, this one is a great ground cover. The only drawback is it's deciduous, so it's not going to be like the evergreen ground covers that you might be used to. But if you're looking for an evergreen ground cover, you cannot do better than golden ragwort. And I noticed a big, beautiful patch of it when I was at the wildflower garden today out in Plantations. This has beautiful yellow flowers, as you can see in these pictures here. It blooms early in spring. It's in the aster family, but it's a spring bloomer. But then after you've cut back the yellow flowers, I like this plant so much I had to show two slides of it. But this slide will give you a better idea of the leaves. The leaves are evergreen, they're basal leaves, they're beautifully rounded and scalloped, and they're very sort of glossy. And they make a wonderful year-round ground cover to substitute for pachysandra. Sedum ternatum is our only native sedum here that likes shade. There's another native sedum. It's very rare in New York State, but it's more of a sun lover. This one is a nice low-growing, good for shade. It also does well in rock gardens. And the yellow star grass that I'm showing with it looks like a little clump of grass until it has those beautiful yellow flowers, actually in the iris family. Now, why am I showing a picture of a cottage garden in England? First of all, I want to thank the British, because they really appreciate native flowers. Native American flowers are much more used in England in some cases. You see them in every public garden. They love our asters. The National Repository of Asters is in Great Britain, and I think they have probably more asters, more varieties and species of asters in that garden in England than we have in any of our public gardens here in the United States, which I think is a riot. But the other reason I'm showing that is to give you some tips on how the British do it. This cottage garden thing is really interesting, because they have our perennials, our big, blustery perennials, in their very confined and very orderly gardens. And I think the confinement is one of the hints as to how to use them in certain situations. And you can have a very formal look with using some very informal plants. This was an attempt that I made to use our asters in a very confined situation, following the idea that a cottage garden will be hemmed in by either lawn or a stone wall in the Cotswolds. You see that a lot. And then they have the flowers sort of dripping over the edge. So this is an attempt here to sort of replicate that, but with more of an American feel. Here are some examples of what I call mini meadows. A lot of people think that to grow a meadow, you need acres and acres and full sun. And in my garden in Hastings, I have virtually no sun except for a little patch along the roadside. And we have this one area that gets maybe half a day late afternoon sun and a little bit of sun peeking in the morning. And right along the road there, these perennials will grow up. The white Joe Pieweed on the right gets to be 9 feet tall. They're much taller than me, these flowers. and they do just fine. I urge all of you who are afraid that you don't have enough room for a mini meadow to go for it. Now, it is nice to have a little fence on one side so they don't look like they're about to plunge into the street. Again, that idea of confinement, or at least the visual idea of confining your meadow is very important for people who don't necessarily want a meadow next door to them to accepting that. Because meadows, some people are still afraid that meadows bring in rodents and this and that. So you have to watch out for your neighbors. You have to make them palatable. I think I heard that word today. And here's another example of a meadow that's grown in partial shade. Once again, you can grow these plants at the edge of a wood and they will do very, very nicely. And they look very nice with a row of trees as background. It makes for a very soothing kind of appearance. And they do very well in partial shade. Now, these plants are what I would call the stalwarts of the dry shade garden. How many of you have to cope with dry shade? It's probably the gardener's bane, right? Whitewood aster has beautiful leaves all season long, and then it has these beautiful white flowers right now. And then right above it is the wreath goldenrod, Solidago acacia. And that plant is another stalwart of dry shade. It's not like other goldenrod. It only gets to be about 6, maybe 8 inches high, and it droops over. It has this sort of arching form to it. Very, very compatible with any other formal plantings that you might have, and it really lights up the late fall garden, and it is totally drought proof. It will bloom. I don't water these parts of my gardens, and we've had a terrible, terrible droughty summer, and they're still blooming just fine. This is aster snow flurry, and that's the white one sort of dripping over the wall like that. This is a ground cover aster that's been recently developed. It's aster ericoides, but this is a cultivated variety that really hugs the ground, makes a beautiful ground cover. The purple aster above that is October skies, that's oblongifolius. And that one is a very late, late blooming aster, so that it really gives the late fall, which is right now, that one's going to be blooming into, in our part of the country, in Hastings, which is just north of New York City, that will bloom right up into the end of October. This is another shot of that same garden with the little snow flurry aster, and over the top of that is purple lovegrass, which is one of my favorite grasses. When it catches the light this time of year, it's a really glorious thing. Now, this is something you probably have a lot of around here, being that there are probably a lot of old farms still around Ithaca, and these old fields, they grow up, and they're a wonderful and beautiful thing, too. And in fact, if you look at an old field and you sort of dissect it, you look at how easy it would be to use that as a model for a garden. On the one side, on the right side in this particular photograph, you have the encroaching forest. You have the forest edge. Moving out from that, you have the shrub border. And then you have a bit of opening where you still have a meadow. Now, all you really need to do to turn this into a garden is to mow a path down the middle of that, and you've really got your garden. And a very low-maintenance garden it would be. And here's an example of someone in the Catskills who basically did just that. This garden is one of the most beautiful gardens I've ever seen. There is nothing is planted. This was all done with mowing. And I just want to leave you with this one last look at Hypericum, the shrub Hypericum I talked with before, and a photograph of my nephew staring at our folly and wondering how on earth he can get into it. And I really urge you all to bring some mystery and some fun into your gardens and attract the children to be in them, because we need to get them out again into the woods and into our gardens. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions and clarify anything I've said today, tonight. Thank you. Yes?
I had a problem with the vibrating leaf beetle.
Ugh. This is a question about viburnum leaf beetle, and are the exotics the same or less or more susceptible to viburnum leaf beetle? I believe what I heard today actually from an expert is that the leather leaf, the very leathery leaved ones that are exotic, those seem to be the most resistant of all to the viburnum leaf beetle. And other than that, I have seen charts where you can, they originally ate Asian and European viburnum because that's where they came from. They're not a native pest. So they were eating already either the European or the Asian, I'm not sure which. So not all of the exotic ones are going to be resistant, but apparently the leather leaf is a more resistant variety. Anyone else? Any other questions? Yes. Well, I actually like those pheromone things, but I live way away. People say that if you have the pheromones and they go into those little buckets, that all you're doing is attracting everybody else's Japanese beetles to your garden. I'm not sure I believe that, but I don't have a lot of neighbors where I'm putting those up, so the ones that I'm catching, I'm pretty sure I'm catching my own. At farm camp, where my daughter used to go, they just pull them off manually and put them into water and drown them. I don't advocate spraying. Essentially, at that time of year, if you're spraying your plants, you're going to probably kill a lot of beneficials as well as the Japanese beetles. Anybody else? Yes. That's a very good question. I've actually been doing that myself. I think it's a very interesting thing to do. It's a lot of fun to test those hardiness zones and to push a little bit. It's actually all you're doing is speeding up a natural process that began ever since the glaciers melted. The plants have been trying to migrate in many cases back to where they were. I don't see any harm in that, and I think that for the most part, those plants will be tolerated by the same insects that are already here. Yes?
Are there industry standards regulating nurseries and greenhouses discouraging them?
Well, there is a nursery association, and there is a voluntary set of standards and guidelines. And I've looked at that, and if in fact the nurseries abided by that, that would be a huge step in the right direction. It does not appear to me that many or most of them are abiding by it. A lot of them are small. It's the ones who should be following it are the big box stores like Home Depot and these others who are still selling Japanese barberries and other horrors. A lot of nurseries are mom-and-pop operations. They sell what they've always sold. It's hard to get the word out in an industry that's so fragmented. Any other questions? Any clarifications? Thank you very much.